Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're live and in living voice from the KTM studios. If today is the 21st of March, 2020. And if it's 21st of March, 2020, where you are, we're here. And if it's not, we aren't. Well, maybe we are, but we could be.
The what of March?
It's not the 21st?
No.
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 I'm sorry.
It's the 14th.
I'm a week off.
How are we doing a rerun of the future?
It is.
That's amazing.
March 14th. It's the day after Friday the 13th, and I'm discombobulated.
Ah, that's what's going on. I liked the original version of this, that somehow we're doing a rerun from the future. Because if today is not the 21st, this is a rerun.
I just glanced at the calendar and saw Saturday, and I said it had to be the 21st because because this week has been so long. This was an anti-leap week. It was the kind of long one we had in the fall where it was twice as long as normal. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we need to do some disclosures and disclaimers. First, the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if today is March 14th, where you are. And you're welcome to give us a call. But we also need to tell you that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of the radio program, it's also the name of an investment advisory firm. Registered with the SEC, located in Salado, Texas.
Yes, but that doesn't mean that we provide investment advice on the air. In fact, the opposite. Investment advice is something that has to be tailored to the individual needs of a person. So in the case of you listeners, we don't have that. We don't have your correct measurements, so your waist size and your arm length and all that good stuff. So this is educational in nature and intended to be so.
And even if we knew everything that we needed to know about you, the fact that we're giving you the advice in public would violate the Gramm-Leach-Bliley
Privacy Act, yes.
Financial Institution Privacy Act, and we'd be in deep doo-doo.
Yes. In order for us to get that information, you would have to tell us all of those personals over the air. So,
yeah. Anyway, we also need to tell you that we do not pay for this radio program, nor are we paid for this radio program. We do advertise on KTEM, but we advertise for the radio program. Now, that is an interesting disclosure that you should probably file away someplace as being one of the more interesting disclosures. The information that we present on this program in an educational format is and has been obtained from sources we deem, I love to use that word,
it's
reliable
and accurate. And we're bringing it back. There are people that have been using deem around me. Now,
really?
I'm taking credit because they didn't get it from us, but I encourage it when I hear it.
Yeah, I like ilk, too.
Yes.
Anyway, we get this from things like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times. Sources that we believe are reliable and generally have been reliable in the past, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness or accuracy of the information we present.
How about efficacy? We can throw that one in there, too. Completeness, accuracy, or efficacy.
I don't know about efficacy.
No guarantee or warranty of completeness, accuracy, or efficacy, or any other matter for that matter.
Well, efficacy would apply to advice, and we're not giving advice, so we probably ought not to use efficacy.
Well, it could also apply to pharmaceuticals.
But we're not giving pharmaceuticals. We don't have farms.
No, you're correct. All right, so that's the right word to use.
Even pharmaceutical farms.
But we could still say that there's no efficacy implied. See? Then we can be like every other disclaimer
on
the small print for everything is you have a bunch of words that don't mean anything about the disclaimer in there.
And so, says that don't listen to anything we say because we will deny
in advance everything that we're about to say that we didn't deny.
Yeah.
Right.
That's cool. We could be lawyers.
Or politicians.
Well, we had a week in the market.
Boy, did we.
And I want to lead off by saying there's something that occurs from time to time, generally about once a decade, called a black swan. And if you've not heard of a black swan, it's something that was presumed not to exist prior to discovery that it existed. And, because that's the way it was with black swans. But we had two black swans, and that's pretty impressive. First one was the coronavirus. I don't think it's kind of like nobody expected the Spanish Inquisition, or in this case, the coronavirus. Actually, some people did, but most of them got laid off.
They were all at Monty Python.
There apparently was a there was an organization in the CDC that was eliminated by the federal government in the last budget.
It wasn't that the organization. There was in the National Security Council, there is a subcommittee that informs the council on pandemics and infectious disease.
And it was eliminated.
Yes, it was eliminated early on in the Trump administration.
We should have seen that as a warning signal, because the thing that you're least prepared for is the thing that's going to happen.
And usually you, when this is, let's take a step back. So rather than too much negativity on the president or, you know, it's really easy to have hindsight 2020 here. But the reality is that how many times have you been cleaning out your garage and you came across something and you said, I'm never going to use this again.
And you
throw
it away.
And the next week, the very next week.
Absolutely. I do that with what does this silly part go
right.
to?
Pandemics? We don't even have those anymore. Let's get rid of this. So that's what's going on. And as much as we want to believe it, people in authority are no more intelligent than the rest of us. So they make decisions.
You're messing with my bubble, man.
And they say things like, man, we spent a lot of money on that. We haven't needed this since, like, what? What? 1918? Get rid of this thing.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir, guys. Enjoy the show. Got a question for you. In the Wall Street, they're considering shutting down the New York Stock Exchange. One thing that kind of tickled my interest is one of the most important things that, according to this article, they do is a 4 p.m. closing auction that determines end-of-day prices. Can you – I mean, I kind of know what futures are, and I know that they buy and sell during the day, but how does this closing auction compare to the other two types of transactions? I'll hang up on this entire
thing. All right.
Well, first off, let me clarify something. They're not thinking about closing the New York Stock Exchange. They're thinking about closing the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange.
This is a different thing.
Which is a different thing altogether.
It used to be that's where all the trading took place. Now it's where about 1% of the trading takes place.
There's a tradition more than anything else, because it doesn't occur on the NASDAQ, and a lot of stocks trade on the NASDAQ. An end of day normalization of prices that's done on the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And it's a tradition more than anything else.
Yeah. If you've ever seen the pictures of the people, you have seen the pictures. If you've ever watched the news on the day where there's a market movement up or down, you're going to see some person wearing either a blue kind of doctor's looking shirt, jacket, or just a sports coat, and they generally are touching their head somehow. Either the failed penguin. Are you familiar with the failed penguin?
No.
The failed penguin, this is the academic term for it. It's when you take both of your hands and put them up just behind, palm into your head, just behind your ears, with your elbows facing out. If you look at the end of the losing team at the end of a ball game.
That was a failed penguin.
That's the failed penguin. And usually on the stock market news, you see some picture or another of failed penguin on the trading floor.
That person looking distressed.
They're not going to have any people to take pictures of when the dark market drops.
Oh, but they have
stock footage.
They have stock footage.
So they'll just pull it
back
up.
And that's what they've been using anyway.
And they'll be like, whoa, I look great in this picture. Oh, it's from 20 years ago.
The point is that, at the end of the day, there are stocks that haven't traded. And if they haven't traded, what's their price? Or if they traded in the middle of the day, but the market moved afterwards and they didn't trade after that. So what
they still have to record the price.
They have a formal normalization of price. It's done on the floor. It doesn't have to be done on the floor. It can be done electronically. It can be done virtually. It's just a tradition. And if they stop trading on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, you won't notice it, because many stocks are traded on the NASDAQ. Most of the stock trades that go on the New York Stock Exchange are done electronically already anyway.
And the ones that do take place on the floor are usually between big dealers. So you're talking about Bank of New York Mellon trading with Wells Fargo, and they can pick up a phone and do that. So it's a place that is more tradition than anything else, and the tradition is to stand cheek by jowl and scream very loudly and wave your arms and
vigorously
spray as many of your bodily fluids on each other as you possibly can,
which may not be the best solution.
So they're saying maybe they should shut that down for a little bit. It's like boxing matches. It's probably there are contaminants spreading between the boxers.
You can actually see them.
Yeah.
Just large droplets.
Yeah, you don't need a microscope. You can tell that there are bodily fluids being exchanged here.
And you mentioned ETFs and mutual funds. Mutual funds price at the end of the day, basically the closing price of the stocks at the end of the day, and that closing trades at the end of the day is just to help the mutual funds figure out what they're worth at the end of the day.
Yeah, we'll put a bookmark on that because it has something to do with what we're going to talk about in just a bit. So just hold that in mind about how they price mutual funds.
Now, ETFs, you mentioned trade during the day, and you're right. And one of the things we were going to talk about today, and I think Jake wants to talk about it too, is that a number of ETFs have traded well away from their net asset value. In other words, the underlying stock portfolio has a price. When you look at all the prices on the stock, but you look at the exchange-traded fund, and the price can be quite different because they're having trouble either buying or selling the underlying stocks.
So let me explain that a little bit. That just got into something complicated, and you're like, why are you getting into this complicated thing right in the middle of this big panic? Well, it's not that complicated once it's explained. Okay, what is a mutual fund? The ones that we're talking about are Investment Company Act of 1940 regulated facilities that are designed for you and other people to pool their money together with one or a group of managers making the decision on how that gets invested. And your ownership is literally the part that you own in the portfolio. So you own a percentage of the portfolio based on how much you put in and what you bought and what they're worth. So what are they worth? This is the bookmark. At the end of the day, when the New York Stock Exchange is done trading, when the NASDAQ is done trading, there's a final price on all those stocks. And the mutual funds say, this is how many shares of that stock we own. So this is the value of our holding in that position. And they add that all up, and they look at the number of shares that they have issued as a mutual fund, which if you think about it is just percentages or a percentage of ownership across these things. And then you can say, all right, this is how much your ownership in the mutual fund is worth. So when you get an account statement from a mutual fund, it'll say NAV on there somewhere. That's net asset value. That means you actually own the things that are being bought by the mutual fund. You don't own the mutual fund. If you think about that for just a second, it will make more sense. They're just an intermediary that you're owning stocks through. You can't choose to sell any of the individual stocks in the portfolio. That's up to the manager. But you own those stocks, and that's how your value is based. In an ETF, they don't wait to close of day to figure out what the mutual fund is worth based on what's underneath it, what it owns. Instead, they're doing it based on what you're willing to buy or sell that mutual fund for. So you may be buying a mutual fund at a price that's...
An ETF.
Right. I'm still talking mutual fund. Okay. We're about to flip over. You may be buying a mutual fund, but it won't trade in the middle of the day. The price is going to be the end of day price, and it'll happen the next day. On an ETF, it's trading all day long. And you could trade it after hours. You can trade it before hours. After hours, it's a pretty fixed price. It's mostly supposed to be the NAV. But if it's been trading all day at well below or well above the value of its underlying stock, it just stays there. So there's some extra danger, and we've actually talked about this for a long time, that as long as everything is liquid, as long as the ability to sell the underlying positions is near instantaneous, then an ETF will stay right next to the value of its underlying stock positions, its underlying bond positions. But it's going too fast now. So what he was saying is that there are a number, a relatively large number of ETFs that are not trading based on what they own anymore, but rather based on panic and greed values that have nothing to do with the underlying investments, or at least very little to do with the underlying investments.
But in answer to your question, the closing of the floor of the New York Stock Exchange would have no noticeable effect on much of anything, except for the fact that the news media feeds would be really
right.
And Maria Bartiromo couldn't broadcast up with the camera looking down at her POTUS.
Okay, so let's flip to another question besides cleavage for just a moment. what would happen if they did shut down the ability to trade on the stock market? Well, we have a relatively recent example of that happening. Right after 9/11, we didn't have the ability to trade. So we just suspended trading. Suspending trading, it was probably a great idea even if it hadn't been the stock market that was attacked. Because it allowed people to come to grips with some kind of a solution to the panic that they were in, rather than trying to decide each day what the newest thing to approach is, what the newest solution is. And toilet paper is a really great example of this. This is, people are, you know, cracking down on saying, why are they buying toilet paper?
Well, and there are not very many people saying that. You're saying.
Sure. No, on the news, there are people, why toilet paper? Why is it that they're, why toilet paper? And anybody, even people that are buying the toilet paper en masse are saying the same thing. That's not helpful to say, why toilet paper? I'll tell you why toilet paper. Because toilet paper. Why are a lot of people buying toilet paper? Because a lot of other people bought toilet paper. Why are people selling stocks that are valuable at prices that are not valuable? Because a lot of other people are selling stocks that are valuable at prices that are not valuable. It is a herd instinct.
I got to tell you a joke.
Okay, I want to hear it.
And my wife came up with this joke.
Okay.
Do you know the real reason the CDC wants us to wash our hand frequently?
Why is that?
Because there's a shortage of toilet paper.
You gotta wait a second for that one to sink in. Yeah.
She told that at the Salado Clinic the other day, and everybody cracked up.
That was good. Oh yeah,
people. And the other thing that there's apparently at least in Salado and probably elsewhere, they are having to ration bottled water.
Yeah,
and
no
people
more
are
than,
cheating on the rations.
Yeah,
but the point is, why are people buying bottled water?
Then I'll tell you why. This is something that I mean, if you just go back to when this started, all of the emergency preparedness sites, all of them that are set up by the U.S. government, had a list of supplies that you needed to have on hand in case the hurricane knocked your power out.
Or you had an earthquake and you were in California.
Right. And the water wasn't flowing anymore. Now you're out of electricity and water because of the hurricane or because of the earthquake. And these are the things that you need. You need some bottled water and some toilet paper and all right, let's go get those. Well, those are for a different kind of disaster. But the very fact that people began doing it, this is the point, the real point, the behavioral spotlight needs to be focused right in on this. If you were one of the first people to buy toilet paper and you got a good supply, you could be sitting back proud of yourself. Yeah, I knew this was coming. I got ahead of the curve and I bought it all. Yeah, very nice. You did. But you're part of the reason why they all got bought up to begin with, because all of the toilet paper that you have in your house now, which is a lot more than you should, your garage is very padded, shall we say. That's part of the reason why the shelf is empty, because it's going to take you a while to get through all that toilet paper. Toilet paper is not something that decays with time. If you feel like toilet paper is something you should have gotten in this particular emergency, it may tell you that you may need to stock up on toilet paper on a normal basis a little bit more, unless you just like to go to the store. So what's going on? People don't like to feel powerless. when you're afraid, you need something to say that I've done something so that you can set your own mind at ease, so that you can set your family's mind at ease. Hey, we've done these things, even if they're completely ineffective things. So what I recommend everyone do as a first stage in your coronavirus outbreak preparatory plan is step outside and do 10 jumping jacks and come back in. And you said now you can tell everyone that you've done your preparatory 10 jumping jacks. And believe it or not, it'll make you feel better
now, if you're in
about
the,
your preparedness.
If you're
it's
in
very
the
weird.
Army, if you're in the Army, it's not a jumping jack.
What are they called?
The side straddle hop.
Okay, side straddle hop, which just flows trippingly from the tongue.
Oh, yes. But remember, that's one of the things that I was forbidden to say when I was in the Army is jumping jack.
Because there are Janes?
I don't know.
Is it a sexist thing?
It was very clear. It was a side straddle hop.
Okay.
Very clear. Anyway, let's talk about the market.
Look, can I wrap that final piece up?
You can.
The final piece here is... fear requires action and a sense of responsibility to move on to acceptance. So take responsibility for what you're doing right now. It's a very simple thing. Just say, all right, why am I scared? Well, because I don't know what to do. All right, what do I know to do? There are some simple things to do. Do those things. I'm not even going to repeat the things. Well, why, Jake? You should know this stuff. Because it's written in every single news article out there about what you should be doing.
Flush your hands.
So those are the things that you should be doing. No more. You don't need to do more than that. Stay away from people. That may make a lot of us happy. I like people, but some people don't like people. And so it's very nice when they have an excuse to tell people to get away from them. That's it. The stores are going to be open. The grocery stores are going to be, they're going to get restocked. Even if we all get the virus, most of us won't die from it. Some of us will. That's the scary part. But those of us that get it, it's the symptoms, unless they're really severe, are not as bad as the flu. So slow down the spread is what we're trying to do right now. Are you having microphone issues?
No, I'm just trying to see if this knob over here works. It doesn't.
It does not. It hasn't worked for about 20 years.
Well, you know, it's only 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Hey, let's talk about what happened.
In the market?
Yeah,
let's do that.
First off, we've had two black swans and a bear.
Yeah.
Anything else you need to know?
I think that's a good beginning.
The first black swan, in case you hadn't already known this, was something that was pretty much unexpected. And it moves the market or the economy rather substantially in the negative direction. The first black swan was the outbreak of the COVID virus and the fact, actually, the funny thing was when the COVID virus was spreading in China and starting to leave China, the market kept going up, which means that the people really didn't believe it was going to come here. And when it came here and became obvious that it was going to affect the United States, the market went down. Well, the market went down and kind of bottomed actually in the middle of last week. And actually for the week last week, it was starting to come back up. And that was just the COVID virus. What happened following that was the second black swan. And that is that Saudi Arabia has traditionally been the oil price stabilizer. If somebody overproduced, Saudi Arabia would come back, cut back. If somebody underproduced, Saudi Arabia would increase their outflow. If the demand fell off, Saudi Arabia would back off and hold the prices even. The other members of OPEC tended to cheat a little bit. Some of them cheated a lot. But the Saudis were the stabilizer in the market. They decided to open the taps as wide as they could get them open, lower the price as far as they could lower the price of oil because they were mad at the Russians. As a result, oil is down 56% from the beginning of the year. That was the second black swan. It's not getting much press, but that is a biggie. Why is it a biggie? By the way, the Saudis not only have opened the spigots, they have leased every available super tanker that wasn't already leased and are filling them up with oil to be shipped to who knows where. The issue is to flood the market with oil because the Russians wouldn't agree to cut production in face of the coronavirus outbreak. The Saudis wanted to cut production to maintain oil prices at a stable level. And the Russians said, not no, but no. and we're going to hurt the Americans by keeping the production up and putting the shale oil drillers out of business. And the Saudis said, okay, so since you're not going to play ball with us, we're going to show how powerful we are, and we're going to cut the prices tremendously. And it's happening. And indeed, this is going to be a biggie. Why is it going to be a biggie? Because there are a lot of shale oil producers in the United States who are leveraged to the gills, and they need $50 or better, many cases $60 oil to break even. At 30-some dollars, which is where it is, it temporarily dipped all the way down to 20, they can't make a profit, and they're losing money hand over fist, and many of them don't have enough money to lose hand over fist. And what we're going to see if the prices stay down like this, and I think they will, is a lot of oil producers in the United States going out of business. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
It is for them,
but the point is somebody will snatch up the oil rights and the equipment and the employees and go back to work. Now, so we had these two black swans, and then we had a bear. Well, what's a bear? That's when the stock market in a relatively short period of time drops 20% or more. And it was down at its worst point about 27%. Now, the funny thing was, at the end of the week this week, the market picked back up to the point where it was no longer down 20%. So we've either had the shortest bear market in history, or we got a temporary reprieve. So we'll wait and see on that. Yep. Stock market, the Standard Poor's 500 closed at 3386 back on February 19th, which was its record high at the time. It dropped on March 12th to 2480.64, and then on Friday the 13th, it rose 9.36%, which says something about Friday the 13th. I'm not sure what.
Well, you keep mentioning Friday the 13th. Today has a significant value as well.
Why?
It's 3.14 day.
Oh, that's right.
It's pie day.
Well, I don't eat pie, so that's okay.
No.
Anyway, so it's only down 19.93% from its peak.
I only eat pies that are measured by the circumference as defined by a factor of their radius. So
Got it.
That's the only pie I eat.
Well, your pies need to have some radiation, some heat radiation.
Put them in the microwave.
Anyway, so where are we? It's the market, the SPX was down 8.79% for the week. It's still down. Year to date, it's still down from last year at this time, but something happened. The emergency declaration with $50 billion being allocated to the coronavirus apparently made people feel a lot better.
Yeah, this is something last week when we talked about the spending bill, and I laughed about it. It was $8 billion to spend on coronavirus, and I said, this doesn't make any sense at all. This is a non-event when South Korea spent $24 billion, American dollars. They did it in their currency, but converted to American. $24 billion is what South Korea spent, and then we were very proud of our $8 billion. Well, now we're getting more reasonable and expect the number to go up. The different expenditures on this are going to be big, and that's just because it's a big event.
The key thing to recognize about what's going on in the market is, barring some future event that we don't know anything about, both events that cause the stock market to plunge are temporary, and I use a fancy word here, exogenic, meaning they're outside. They're not something from inside the system. The market crash in 2008 and 9 came from an endogenic systemic problem, big words. It means that we had something fundamentally wrong with our financial system, and we did. And it took a long time to fix. We call that an L-shaped recovery. It drops and it kind of runs flat for a while and then very slowly recovers. Looking back at past viral panics, they tend to be V-shaped. Now, sometimes they're U-shaped, but anyway, what happens is we get over them fairly quickly. And when we come back, we generally come back to new highs, higher than, matter of fact, looking back at the fledgling stock market in 1918, which there's information on, the total price from the New York Stock Exchange, there was a dip in the 1918, when the 1918 and 19, when the flu was ravishing the United States and doing the worst damage probably since the Black Death. So, but we were back and going strong in 2019, not 20, in 1919. So this is the way this is likely to play out. It's likely to be violent, relatively short, not particularly pleasant. And the big danger is not from the virus itself, although the virus is going to particularly affect the service side of the economy, which is all that's been going strong for the last year or so. The manufacturing has been in a recession, but the service side is going to take a severe blow in this event. The manufacturing side is taking another blow, and that is that they're running out of parts. I read that AMD down in a number of other places where they make chips down in Austin and is getting ready to lay people off for a very simple reason. Their materials that they get to make the chips come from China, and the Chinese production is shut down. And that's not just true of China. What we're going to see is a lot of shutdowns go on. We're going to see a lot of empty restaurants. As a matter of fact, we kind of saw that a little bit today. On the way in, and those of you who remember, who've been listening to the radio program for a really, really, really long time, we used to count trucks. Why did we count trucks? Because we could say, is there really a recession? This was 1990, 91. Is there really a recession going on here, or is there not?
All the way up through 2000, we were counting trucks.
Into
2007.
Which is sort of a good thing, because traditionally, by the way, the Dow Jones Transportation Index leads the way. On the way into the radio program today, we noticed something on I-35. Normally, Saturday morning, I-35 headed north for reasons known only to God and some economists someplace, or the Commerce Department. There's heavy traffic. Some places, typically on a Saturday morning going north on I-35 coming into the radio program, we see traffic slowed down to the point we're driving below the speed limit because there's just too much traffic. This morning, it was really pleasantly clear. There was still some traffic on the highway. Most of it seemed to be out of state, but nothing, maybe what would you say, 20% of the traffic we normally see?
Yeah, probably 20%. So it was a very nice driving environment.
But that means that the commerce in the United States is slowing down, and you're going to see more of that, and it's going to hurt. It's going to be very painful. So we've got the supply chain disruption. We've got the virus itself that's causing people not to go to restaurants, which is going to cause them to be hurt. But the big danger is in corporate bonds.
Oh, yeah.
Because a lot of companies in the United States, because of the low interest rates and the ease with which they could borrow money for some time, have been rolling over loans to the next loan, and each loan gets a little bigger.
And they're not sitting as much cash as they used to. They put them into longer term holdings.
And the end result of that is, with these shutdowns, there's going to be a lot of companies, particularly in the oil industry, that don't make it. And they're going to fold. And that's going to put stress on the financial system. It is already starting to put stress on the financial system, which is why the Federal Reserve announced they were injecting $1.5 trillion into the system. That's $1 trillion, not billion, which is three times the amount of money that was released by the emergency declaration. Three times? No. Many times.
Yes.
Many, many times. 30 times.
30. 30. Yes.
But why are they doing that? Because
it's not like just being given into the system. That's one of the things that Bernie Sanders really doesn't understand, and was saying if the government has this kind of money to throw around, they should just pay off student debt. I'm like, no, this is a loan.
It isn't the government to begin with.
And it's not the government.
Well, they're buying.
I don't even know how to break that up and say which parts of that you're wrong about, but go ahead.
The banking system, the Federal Reserve, is buying treasury securities on the open market and maybe some other things too. Short term. Now, this is not qualitative and QE. This is not trying to stimulate the economy. It's trying to keep the bank system functioning.
Yeah, it's
because there's a lot of demand for money right now.
Providing liquidity.
And they're preparing for the fact that there's going to be a lot of defaults on loans, and we won't know that for several months. But they're prepared to do that, and what they're doing is they're buying treasury securities from the banks. And that puts cash in the bank's pocket, in their vaults, and that keeps everything flowing. This is going to be, matter of fact, the biggest challenge we're going to face, and I think we're going to face it without even a bump, is the liquidity and the credit crunch that's going to come as a result of many companies going bankrupt. Because every time a company goes bankrupt and says, we're not paying off our bills, somebody holds their bonds or holds their loans, and they're not going to get their money back, or they're only going to get part of their money back. And that takes money out of the system. So the Federal Reserve is pumping money back into the system to cover those losses. But the thing is, we're prepared for this. The big challenge is one we're totally prepared for, because that's the challenge we faced in 2008 and 2009. That's the one we're ready to handle. We really were not ready to handle a pandemic. We really have no plans on handling how the supply chain disruption is hitting us. Although the good news is, and I think it's very good news, we will after this. We will have a solution once we've been burned on something, we're really good at it for a long time, and then we forget about it.
Well, that's why we had the pandemic advisors from 100 years ago, but we haven't had one since then. It's one of those things where it's really hard to know what disaster's coming next, especially when you haven't had that particular disaster for a while. People have asked me for as long as I can remember, and I remember asking it, why did the Romans set up on Pompeii? I mean, everybody knew that was a volcano. The whole island was made by a volcano. Well, we're doing that in a lot of places, and it's just been a very long time since the volcano erupted. We tend to get complacent, and then we tend to put blame on the people that are in charge for their complacency, but we're the ones that elected them. Complacency is something that just happens. It happens due to lack of memory and not studying history. Having a pandemic advisor on your National Security Council may not have done anything different in this particular case. It's not like the president didn't have good advice coming in on coronavirus. But most people took it jocularly. We've had the two most recent sets of cases, well, three if you count Ebola, where everybody's gone on alert. It was stopped over there. The SARS and MERS, SARS was a China thing, and they didn't come. We had a couple of cases hiding here and there, but they all got stopped quickly, and MERS just stayed where it was. It didn't go very far. That was a scary, scary thing.
Because we have very few camels in the United States.
And you're right. And then Ebola. Well, Ebola's difficult to catch, but at the time that we set up the advice to have them on the National Security Council was a time when measles was a real thing. I mean, it's not like it's not real today. We're having outbreaks in weird places where people haven't vaccinated. But measles, as far as contagion, is so much more contagious than anything that we're talking about today when we talk about the flu. Or the measles are contagious up to 60 feet away, airborne. And that's what we used to deal with. So we're still totally capable of doing this, folks. This is something our grandparents or great-grandparents went through on a daily basis with no recourse, only not just to one bug, lots of them. We can do this. And I've heard people say to me multiple times this week, I just don't know if I can take one more thing. And my answer is always the same. You can. You can, because you will. You can do this. Everybody can do this. And when we're done with it, we're going to look back at it and say, yes, this knocked out a lot. But in 10 years, it's going to be a fairly small blip on our radar. In 5 years, we're going to remember and talk about it with jokes. And in 3 years, we're still going to have some sensitive memories. It's a big deal.
There was a interesting thing occurred in the markets in the bond side that is worth paying attention to. In the middle of this week, matter of fact, it was March 10th for bonds, March 5th for stocks, for gold. The price peaked. And you normally see when the market goes down, bonds, we expect that bonds will go up because people will shift from stocks to bonds. As they buy more bonds, the price goes up, the interest rates go down. Matter of fact, interest rate on the 10-year bond dropped to 0.056%, which is the lowest in, since 1790. That's the lowest interest rate we have seen on the 10-year U.S. Treasury.
That's pretty low. Remember a couple of, well, I guess it was about 6 or 8 months ago, and we had a caller that said, what do you think the interest rate's going to hit first, 3% or 2%? It had already been up at 3.
Well,
we said it's hard to tell. We don't know. There's a lot of other influences going on. It may go below 2 before it hits 3. It may go to 3 before it hits 2. Well, it hit 2. And then the caller called back in a few months later and says, what do you think, 2 or 1? Well, I don't know. I'm not sure, but there we could have a black swan. And I listened to the recording to verify that, and we said we could have a black swan. If that hits, then all bets are off, but should head back up to 2. Well, the black swan hit.
Yeah, and then...
Now we're below 1.
And then what happened is both the price of gold and the price of treasuries started falling as the market plunged this week. And they continued to fall, by the way, even though the market went up on Friday, they continued to fall on Friday. Now, that means if you think, okay, a safe haven, I'll bail out of stocks and I'll go into treasuries, or I'll bail out of stocks and I'll go into gold. Well, if you bailed out of stocks at the, like a lot of other people did, and you went to gold, you promptly saw the gold price start down.
Yeah.
And the guesses, it's analysis, but the best guess right now is that there's a lot of people who had short interest, who basically had leveraged the market. They had borrowed money to invest, or they realize now that they're extended too far in their business, and their business is going to have to shut down. And what they're doing is they are selling gold and selling treasuries to raise cash. So if you think gold or treasuries or bonds or a safe haven, as we wrote in the newsletter, things ain't what they used to be and probably never were.
Right. Yeah. And
we got to do commercials.
We do. I want to come back and say, what does black swan even mean? People have a preponderance or a predisposition to use a preponderance of animal terms when talking about the market. So we'll be back and I'll have a simple explanation. In the meantime, we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400.
And I wanted to say, what does the word black swan come from?
It's two words.
It is the word. It is two words, yes. The word black swan is actually two words.
Right. I got to remember that.
Yes. What is it? In the... all the way up to the 1700s, the philosophers and mathematicians would refer to things that were impossible as a black swan, because people had never seen a black swan. All swans are white. Why would there be a black swan? And then they found Australia. And all the swans in Australia...
Not all the swans.
A lot of the swans. Well, I think that all of the swans at that point.
All the native swans?
Yeah, were black swans.
And the indigenous swans.
Right. So what that means is that their impossibility was not only existing when they were calling it impossible, but it was existing in large quantity. And they didn't know about it. Once they knew about it, it caused all of their thought processes to have problems. How do you, when you say something's impossible and then you find it isn't, and it's been your definition of what impossible is, it's like, say, when pigs fly, and then we show up at an island somewhere and there's a herd of, a swine herd of flying, what would you even call that? A flight of pigs? I don't even know how to begin.
Flock.
But, I mean, that's the level. And somebody, we went from, okay, that's a black swan. That never happened. When swans are black, that'll happen. To, oh, well, there's black swans. Well, when pigs fly, that'll happen.
But
oh.
Pigs do fly.
Yeah, we fly them all over the world.
We fly back and forth from China.
That's part of the big
a lot of
trade war over it.
Anyway, we had an unusual week in the market. That's the understatement. And it'd be interesting. It's going to be interesting to watch what happens next week. The key takeaway, and as we're running towards the end of the hour, that's an important thing to take away, is there appears to be nothing seriously structurally wrong with the United States economy. Yes, we're a bit over-leveraged, and that's about to shake out, and it's not going to be pretty, and it's not going to be pleasant, but we're getting rid of a lot of deadwood. The alternative would be to keep cruising wrong, accumulate more deadwood, more zombie companies, until they caused a collapse all by themselves. That would be disastrous. And so I hate to say thank God for the coronavirus and the oil war, because we'll want to talk about this more next year. The probabilities are pretty high that we're going to see in excess of 1 million people die of coronavirus in the United States.
And that sounds like a really large number, but just to kind of take a step back, 300,000 plus people die every month.
From something
here. And that's a lot of people that are dying. And yes, this is really, really bad, but there are a lot of people in our country. So you may even know people that die from this. And you probably know people that have died in car accidents, and you probably know people that have died of cancer. And this is another thing. And the precautions to it are very clear.
But from the standpoint of the economy, this is not a disaster. This is a temporary panic. Now, it's not to say that something could be revealed as the tide goes out. We could find out that there are a lot of people not wearing swimming trunks out there. But it's possible that there could be another black swan. It's possible something more. But from what we've seen so far, there's going to be a lot of pain. And there's going to be a lot of companies that are undersaved. In terms of cash and the ability to secure money, that are going to go under. But when we come back out of it again, let me say this very clearly. I strongly suspect we will go in a restructuring mode to no longer be so dependent on somewhere else to get our stuff.
Right.
We will probably recognize that we need to change the way we approach a lot of things, and it'll be good for us in the long term.
We're going to learn how to work from home a lot better, and I bet there's going to be a lot of software developed on that. Very good software. And I want to address something specifically. We've given this education in the past on the market. We believe that a good approach to investing would be, number one, make sure you have good reserves on hand before you invest, that you will not invest the money that's sitting around for emergencies and so on. Number two, when you invest, be very, very well diversified, spread across the market, and make sure it's in high quality diversification. Okay. Number three, when, not if, the market goes down, remember the first two steps and why you took them. Reserves on hand, high quality, well diversified, weather the storm. It's a lot easier to listen to that advice today than it was 2 months ago. 2 months ago, when we were giving that education out to people, they would hear it and they would go, yeah, but look at all the returns I've gotten in the market and my concentrated portfolios. Just be aware that this is the reason why we've been trying for a decade to let people know diversification and high level of reserves on hand to make sure that you can get through a downturn without having to dip into a downward market. If you sell when the market's down, it's not good. So there are a lot of people that have stocks and bonds that are calling up and saying, should I sell them? Should I sell them? And I say, well, why do you have them? And if they don't know why they have them, I say it's probably not a good time to sell them. Well, let's wait till everything settles out. But it's a really good time to get your notebook out and start determining what you're trying to accomplish. If you're just in it to make a profit, no specific goal, that's not a good enough reason. Define your goal. What are you trying to do? And then get some help with it.
The other thing is, and you probably recognize this already if you're still in the market, trying to time the market to get out and get back in at the right time has proven historically to be impossible. Now, occasionally somebody will get lucky and get out and get in at the right time, and they make headlines for a decade thereafter. But what we've seen is those are the people who normally start some kind of fund. Matter of fact, famously, several people did after the last market crash and have since lost their shirts, figuratively.
Is it like a laundry thing?
Yeah.
It's a laundry disaster. They lost their shirts.
The point is, timing the market, getting out and getting back in at the right time has been, nobody has successfully done it consistently over any length of time. Occasionally somebody will get lucky. So the best route, the best returns over the long term as a group of investors are the people who get in, get a well-diversified portfolio, and like Jake said, have adequate reserves and simply ride it out. For instance, Thursday may have been the market bottom. And my gut tells me, nope, there's going to be more, but my gut is not always right about these things. So we don't know. So was Thursday the day to get back in? I don't know. And I've been at this for 37 years. I was a stockbroker for 25 years and since then been an investment advisor representative and can tell you that I have never found anybody who's been successful doing it. And I, with all my experience and education, would not even try. So we're coming to the end of our time. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach and
we'll be back next.